From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The big media story this week concerns an erstwhile media darling. Can you guess?
One candidate voted against the Bush tax cuts both times and pushed more restrictions on gun owners' rights. The same candidate joined Ted Kennedy to sponsor amnesty for illegals. Hillary Clinton? No. John McCain. John McCain, surprisingly liberal.
Arizona Senator John McCain, once revered and then reviled by political pundits when he pandered to Pat Robertson, whom he once likened to Louis Farrakhan, mocked by TV pundits and the op-ed page of the New York Times when his Straight Talk Express blew out all its tires last summer, is currently riding a wave that could lead to the Republican nomination. But now he confronts the fiercest, most relentless enemy of his life, not counting the Viet Cong. No, not Mitt, or Hillary, or Bill, or even Carl. They're pikers compared to the legions of Rush. Limbaugh inveighs against him hour after hour.
So the McCain camp is doing its best to say that private sector business experience is irrelevant.
Take a bathroom break. Go out to lunch. You won't miss anything.
He is not the choice of conservatives, as opposed to the choice of the Republican establishment.
But the Republican establishment is no defense against the on rush.
He has curtailed free political speech. It was called McCain-Feingold. He opposed tax cuts, one of only a few Republicans to do so.
We took that last clip from Thursday's O'Reilly Factor on Fox News, where former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum attacked McCain and conservative WABC radio talk show host Monica Crowley defended him. Sort of.
He's bad on illegal immigration, bad on the Bush tax cuts, bad on anti-torture legislation, bad on campaign finance reform. But for 30 years before that, John McCain has had a long, extensive conservative record of backing tax cuts and cutting federal spending and being a deficit hawk, being a national security hawk, and has been consistently pro-life.
The O'Reilly segment was called John McCain and Conservative Angst, and there's a lot of it. And though it might hurt conservatives to hear it, the Republican Party is beginning to look an awful lot like the Democrats of yore. That intra-party cracking sound is audible throughout the conservative media. In a recent post from the conservative blog called Red State, McCain is slammed as, quote, the voice of the Republican Party. The blogger writes, if I have to put up with a lying, slimy president, I would much rather have a Democrat that gave lip service to the far left to get elected than a Republican that ignores the conservative right. Meanwhile, after pronouncing McCain's campaign stone dead for months, the mainstream media are wiping egg off their face, a motion so continuous this season it has to be causing repetitive stress syndrome. And dizziness. They love him, mock him, condemn him as a hypocrite, resurrect him as a hero, but he keeps slipping out of their grip. It probably doesn't matter. The mainstream media are irrelevant when it comes to John McCain. He has bigger fish to fry, namely a bumping and biting bull shark endlessly circling called Rush.
Once upon a time, like 6 years ago, journalists wrote the word earmark inside quotations and followed it with an explanatory paragraph telling us how they were line items slipped into appropriation bills, either openly or covertly. Well, the term earmark is no longer inside baseball.
The people's trust in their government is undermined by congressional earmarks, special interest projects that are often snuck in at the last minute without discussion or debate.
In Monday's State of the Union address, President Bush tossed around the term pretty casually.
If you send me an appropriations bill that does not cut the number and cost of earmarks in half, I'll send it back to you with my veto.
The word's ascent into the political spotlight was mirrored by a change in meaning. Earmark used to refer only to how a program's funds were procured. It was about the procedure. Now, if someone uses the word earmark, it's implied that they're talking about federal money spent on wasteful or even ridiculous local projects. The word earmark has become synonymous with that nasty old pejorative, pork. Jonathan Weissman, staff writer for The Washington Post, says there could certainly be more transparency surrounding earmarks and that we could do without bridges to nowhere. But earmarks, he says, aren't altogether useless.
Most members of Congress would say, hey, I know better than some bureaucrat at the Department of Transportation what roads in my district most need attention. I should have the right to be able to allocate money that way. If you as a lawmaker suddenly don't have the ability to put an earmark into a bill, it seems like the job that you wanted to do in Washington is taken away from you.
CNN and CBS and other news organizations have been taking ongoing looks at earmarks, and they've pulled some easy targets out.
The Sparta Teapot Museum is being financed by
Why
your
is
tax
it getting
dollars.
$500,000 of your federal
Members
tax
of Congress
money.
Usually get earmarks for pet projects back in their districts.
Branson
it helps
Bishop
them get reelected.
The biggest mule festival in the United States, and it is here. Federal taxpayers are being turned into jackasses.
But it is historically and ultimately a legitimate legislative mechanism, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, the Iraq Study Group, that bipartisan group, was an earmark. It was created as a little what we would call a pet project by a congressman from Virginia, Republican Frank Wolf. Most research into breast cancer is done through earmarks. Earmarks are the method by which members of Congress can exact policy.
So when exactly did the term earmark become more or less synonymous with wasteful spending and political payoffs?
Tom DeLay, who was House Majority Leader for quite some time, really used earmarks to solidify and then expand Republican control, not only of Congress, but of Washington itself. He used earmarks to help Republicans in marginal districts gain control of their seats and make sure they would be reelected time again. But he also used it to bequeath favors on K Street, on favored lobbyists and lobbying organizations. It was Jack Abramoff, the felonious Republican lobbyist who called Capitol Hill the earmark favor factory. And it was really with Abramoff that earmarks became the word synonymous with pork.
And this is a key point because it was the Democrats who were using the word as a cudgel against DeLay and the rest of the GOP.
Absolutely. They used earmarks very much against the Republicans and used Jack Abramoff, obviously, against the Republicans in their campaign to successfully win control of Congress in 2006.
Is this a case of Frankenstein's monster turning against him? Because now the Democrats are in Congress and now the president is counting earmarks, essentially accusing them of using their power in the Congress to wantonly distribute pork.
This is actually in some ways utterly ridiculous. In 2001, when President Bush came into power, his first budget director, Mitch Daniels, declared war on earmarks. And Republicans basically just ignored that war on earmarks. Earmarks utterly proliferated between the year 2001 and 2005. They doubled, they tripled in some bills. And now that the Democrats are in control, suddenly George W. Bush has discovered the evil of earmarks.
Well, it sounds positively Rovian, and yet Rove, as far as we can tell, is no longer working for the White House. Do you have any idea whose political ingenuity is behind turning this brand new pejorative against the Dems?
I would point to House Minority Leader John A. Boehner of Ohio. Boehner has always really hated these things, and his hands are clean. He has never requested earmarks for his fairly hardscrabble district in Ohio. He's the one who said, you know, one of the big problems in 2006 was that Republicans were successfully tarred as the big spenders. And that contributed to Republican defeats, especially in the House of Representatives. So Boehner said, if we can just grab onto this earmark issue, try to be cleaner than the Democrats and really hit them on it, no one will remember that we were the earmark kings because we are going to regain our mantle as the party of fiscal rectitude. And what you're seeing President Bush do right now is back up the House Republicans. They are the ones that tried to make this huge issue.
We spoke to a group called Citizens Against Governmental Waste. since they don't want to put themselves in the position of judging what is a worthy project and what is a shameless waste of taxpayer dollars, from their perspective, in the end, there really is no difference between earmarks and pork.
Well, let's put it this way. If you didn't do these earmarks, you're probably going to have little to no effect on the federal budget. It's not that the Congress is piling on additional spending. It's just carving out the spending that would already be there. It used to be that a huge pot of money would just go to, say, the Department of Transportation. Then the Department of Transportation would farm that out to state departments of transportation or local road authorities, and they would decide how to spend the money. It simply would give the bureaucracy more power in deciding how to spend that money. There's a balance here to be struck between the prerogative of Congress and the ability of bureaucrats basically to set their own priorities.
Okay, so just to recap, a legitimate but often abused legislative mechanism has now become synonymous with sleazy pork barrel spending. And that's not necessarily fair, but the toothpaste is out of the tube. Will they forever be deemed prima facie evidence of the culture of corruption?
I think that actually, as soon as we start concentrating on much bigger issues, we'll kind of forget about this. Everybody agrees that it got way out of hand, that there are now hundreds of thousands of earmarks in the federal budget every year. When they get down to like maybe 15,000 earmarks, everyone will stop yelling at each other.
Okay, I'll believe that when I see it. But Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Weissman covers Congress for The Washington Post. As is custom for the majority party, the Democrats are currently responsible for about 60% of congressional earmarks. And if earmark is now a dirty word, there's only one natural response. Change the word. Here's Nancy Pelosi at a press conference over the summer.
Why don't we just leave this room today forgetting the word earmark? This is legislatively directed spending.
Legislatively directed spending. Or we could follow the terminology of the Government Accountability Office, the investigative arm of Congress. It issued a report this week on the subject of congressional funding directions.
On the brink of Super-Duper Tuesday, the media frantically speculate. Traditionally, at this point in the election cycle, most parse the primaries for momentum. This is the group Slate senior writer Tim Noah calls the momentocracy. But in the absence of the Big Mo, especially on the Democratic side, the media's focus has shifted to the wonky work of delegate counting. After all, it's the count and not the Mo that really matters. The candidate who first hits the magic number of delegates, 2,025 for Democrats and 1,191 for Republicans, wins. Tim Noah calls the delegate counters the arithmocrats, and you can see them calculating away throughout the media. He says that back in the old pre-primary days, when party leaders picked delegates in smoke-filled rooms, there was no popular vote for the momentocrats to ponder.
First, you have to remember that the primaries were not the chief determinants in selecting party nominees, really not until 1972. That was the first year when states held primaries that selected the majority of all convention delegates. As the primaries became more important, they were treated more like the general election in that the various media outlets covering them were tempted to make projections. And eventually, the projections actually started designating the nominees. For example, if you go back to 2004, you will find that George W. Bush called John Kerry to congratulate him on securing the nomination before he had the necessary number of delegates. Basically, what happens is that the media reaches a point where the momentum is sufficiently well established that they feel they can comfortably guess, but their predictions blur to some extent the distinction between predicting an outcome and determining it. Because, of course, once the press and also political professionals create a consensus about who's going to have the necessary delegate count, that influences subsequent primaries.
The states themselves have embraced the concept of momentum, which is why so many have tried to put their primaries first and, in so doing, basically invalidate their own delegates.
Florida is a great example of that. The Republican Party in Florida is congratulating itself for having moved up the primary, even though they endured the penalty from the Republican National Committee of losing half of their delegates. Yet the Florida GOP is delighted. Why? Because Florida got to vote when the question of who the nominee was going to be was still up in the air.
But as you say, this year we've run into a bit of a problem. The momentocrats, as you call them, are left speechless, and they can't really point to any snowballing momentum. So some of them, at least, have fallen back on the old-fashioned delegate count that they deemed so unimportant years ago.
Right. The New York Times, for example, Adam Nagorny, wrote a piece the other day saying, we're just going to have to count the accumulation of delegates. And it isn't even a question of counting them state by state. It's a question of counting them congressional district by congressional district. The Wall Street Journal is still embracing the momentum model, and they had a piece on Barack Obama earlier this week saying he's going to have real trouble on Super Tuesday because he's not doing very well in the polls in most of the bigger states on Super Tuesday. And that's true also. So it may be that a careful delegate count is not necessary after Super Tuesday if a clear trend emerges. Basically, of these two ways of looking at the election, both seem to have plausibility right now. We don't know which way will end up being the superior way.
And on the 24-hour cable news channels, it seems like they're throwing everything against the wall like spaghetti, trying to see what might stick.
You know, the political junkies have kind of warring impulses here because on the one hand, they like the idea of being able to name the winner before the winner really emerges. On the other hand, none of the political reporters working today have ever had the thrilling experience of witnessing a brokered convention.
Yeah.
And it is the ultimate fantasy of all political reporters to go to a political convention where there is actually news. And that may happen this time.
You know, I think that one reason perhaps that the media shy away from all of this delegate counting is that it's so darn hard. I mean, each news organization has a different count for the current primaries. CNN has Obama leading Clinton 63-48. The New York Times has him leading 34-21. I mean, that's not even close. And then there are the super delegates. Is part of the problem here that there's no accurate way to count the delegates?
There's no agreed upon way to count the delegates. The New York Times, for example, I think rather fastidiously, is not counting the delegates awarded at the Iowa and Nevada caucuses because those numbers are not official until subsequent in-state caucuses are held.
And then we have the superdelegates to deal with. Who are they?
The superdelegates are party regulars who are unpledged. They can flit from one candidate to another like honeybees. Hillary Clinton, for example, is winning among the superdelegates now. But if Obama consistently beats Hillary from now on in the primaries, then all of these party regulars will likely want to go with the popular choice, and they will migrate over to Obama. And the same is true in the Republican side. They don't call them superdelegates, but they are essentially the same thing. They're members of the Republican National Committee.
Seeing what we've seen this year, could we see this again in 4 years? And will that change the way the political press reports?
I think it's very hard to say because I don't know whether this is a fluky year or whether this is the public sort of permanently settling into a pattern of not rallying around an individual candidate early on.
Tim, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Tim Noah is senior writer for Slate. Many have declared the biggest losers of this primary season to be the pollsters. That's why some who crave predictions are turning instead to the markets. Political futures markets, as they're called, allow you to bet on everything from delegate counts to which party will control the Senate after 2008. They've been seen as more reliable forecasters because they draw on the wisdom of crowds. But Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek, wouldn't bet on it, and he's been following two of the biggest political markets.
Okay, you've got the Iowa Electronic Market, run out of the University of Iowa, where people can essentially place bets on who will get the nominee and who will be the president. They're traded as futures contracts, so if it's priced at 55 cents, that means there's a 55% chance that person will win. It pays off a dollar if your person wins and pays off zero if your person loses. There's also InTrade, which is based in Ireland, which is a real exchange for all sorts of events, political, economic events, everything from when Saddam would be captured to the odds of a recession. And there they have contracts on not only who will be the Democratic nominee and who will be the next president, but on every single primary we've had so far.
Do we know how many people are betting on these markets and how much money is being wagered overall?
Well, it's really not that much. At InTrade, they have 70,000 registered customers and 6,000 to 10,000 people who have traded something in the past month. The volume in all the 2008 political markets so far is about $40 million of risk being traded. On the one hand, it sounds like a lot, but when you compare that to the activity in the real stock market, it's really a tiny amount.
There was a headline in the Las Vegas Sun from a couple of weeks ago. It read, quote, "Markets pick 'em better than the polls." And, you know, Dan, this is a common claim that these futures markets are better predictors of outcomes than the pundits, than polls, tea leaves, you name it. But you don't buy that. How come?
When you look at the activity in these markets, I think it's clear that in many ways they are just reacting to conventional wisdom rather than setting it. What you see frequently is the action of the prices really following what happens in the polls and what happens as the tallies are counted. And we saw this earlier this month after Iowa, which the markets didn't really project Obama would win. He went to the front runner status. The contract price soared from about 25 to 35, meaning that he had a 25% chance of winning the nomination before Iowa to 35 immediately after. And in those next few days, when he seemed to be gaining a lot of momentum in New Hampshire, and the polls were showing that he was doing quite well, that spiked to 70, which is a very high price for one of these contracts. And the Hillary contracts were obviously going in the opposite direction. Now, in the afternoon of the day of the New Hampshire primary, when exit polls started to leak out, and when we first started to get the reports from television showing that Hillary was ahead, the Obama numbers started to plummet back towards where they were before, and the Hillary numbers started to go up again. So I think it's a very clear example there of the markets reacting to this new information that comes out into the public realm.
So why are these markets so celebrated as being more accurate than the pollsters?
On the one hand, the financial media, places like CNBC, the Wall Street Journal, financial news blogs, they like these prediction markets because they're in a language that their viewers can understand. It's a way of talking about politics without getting into political wonkery and insidery language. And the second is that, you know, we've seen many examples of polls, even though they say they have a margin of error, people taking polls as gospel. And when you have tight elections, the margin of error can really make all the difference in a poll being right or wrong. InTrade, the biggest political prediction market, is proud that in 2004, on the day of the campaign, its markets accurately predicted the outcome of every state election except for Alaska. And I don't think that can necessarily be said about all the polls because of their margin of error.
So then they are more accurate, and yet you wouldn't advise anybody to put their money in one.
I think they're more accurate than polls maybe on the day of an election that's happened after 8 or 9 months of campaigning where the conventional wisdom was that Bush was going to beat Kerry. I think that was the conventional wisdom at the time. They are completely inaccurate if you want to know today who is going to win the election in November. You know, back in April 2007 when the campaigns got started, Rudy Giuliani was the prohibitive favorite in these InTrade markets. So what was the market telling us at that time? The Rudy Giuliani contract was trading at 40 cents on the dollar, which was the highest among all Republicans back in April. Today it's at a penny.
Do you have any tips at all for a safe bet out there on InTrade?
Perhaps if they had a contract on the inaccuracy of polls.
Dan, thank you so much.
Anytime.
Dan Gross is a senior editor at Newsweek and author of the Money Box column at Slate. Thank you.
Why No Rich Techie Should Ever Buy a Sports Team. That's the title of a blog posting that has sparked an interesting debate about journalistic ethics. The rich techie in question is Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban. The guy who wrote those words is Will Leach, editor of the popular sports blog Deadspin. Leach interviewed Cuban for GQ magazine and later wrote about the experience for a blog called ValleyWag, which, like Deadspin, is owned by Gawker Media. Cuban is not a fan of Gawker Media, or of Deadspin, or of giving interviews. He did, however, agree to grant an interview to GQ magazine. So, without naming names, Cuban questioned Leach's journalistic ethics in blogging about that discussion. And, you know, I can see Cuban's point. He had, after all, granted an interview not to someone named Will Leach, but to GQ magazine. But does that arrangement limit Leach's ability to discuss the interview? We've asked him on to answer that very question. Will, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you for having me, sir.
If you had called Mark Cuban and said, "Hi, this is Will Leach, Deadspin would like to give you an interview," what would he have said?
Oh, I suspect he probably would have said no. The first thing I did say in the interview was, just to make this clear, I reminded him that, like, I also, in addition to working for GQ, I actually also write for Deadspin.com.
And what did he say?
I believe his quote was that he found Deadspin the inside edition of sports, which was kind of cool because I thought maybe that would, you know, make me Pat O'Brien or something.
Well, on the subject of Pat O'Brien, who got into a jam regarding some sexual indiscretions, the particular item that appeared on Deadspin that apparently is what has Mark Cuban seething was a photograph of him in the midst of a lap dance, and he wasn't the one doing the dancing.
That was, I think, a year and a half ago. He had responded after that and said, "Hey, here's who that was. Here's my response to that." And that was posted immediately with an update.
Okay. So anyway, you're in the room with him and you say, "Hi, I'm Will. And oh, by the way, I'm also the editor of Deadspin." And he uses his inside edition line, but proceeds with the interview. Did he express any reservations about proceeding, or did he just dig right in?
He did ask if the interview was for GQ and not Deadspin, and I said that was correct.
You may have not had an explicit contract with him to limit your reporting to GQ, but he could be forgiven for understanding that he had such a contract.
First off, the story I wrote that he was upset about was not actually for Deadspin. It was for a site called ValleyWag, which apparently he also doesn't like, information that I did not know. And I would understand his point a little more if in the ValleyWag piece I said, "You know, I promised Mark Cuban that I would only write about certain things in GQ, but now I'm going to tell you all the stuff I couldn't tell you in GQ." Really, that's not what happened at all. All I did was actually just quote one exact quote from him from the GQ piece. It seems strange that he would object to material that he said in one medium and then somehow have a problem with it in another medium.
When you went to see him, you understood that this was a pretty rare event, a person-to-person interview with Mark Cuban, who previously had done almost all of his media interviewing via email, right? You knew this was a pretty good get.
Oh, certainly. I was very flattered to have the assignment, yes.
Don't you think you owed it to him to at least give him a heads up in advance of the blog item that, you know, notwithstanding his fully disclosed displeasure with your organization, that you were going to go ahead and post an item about the interview experience? Wouldn't that have been the decorous thing to do?
Well, certainly, I think if I would have known that he did have the issues with ValleyWag that he had, yes, I would have been happy to drop him a line and be like, "Hey, I'm going to be writing about our interview." I'm not sure that's entirely necessary, but yeah, it would have been polite in that circumstance. But certainly, again, as I mentioned in my email to him that I believe was posted on his site, any disagreement that he had with ValleyWag is news to me. I think it's a misconception that everyone at Gawker Media all sits in a room and plans out their day. I've literally never met a single person that works at ValleyWag. I think it's asking a lot of a freelancer to understand the historical animosities between every single one of your subjects and the publications that you may potentially write for.
Freelancers have always been guns for hire. They've historically had many masters. But in the digital world, in the world of the blogosphere, obviously there is much more opportunity to find different audiences immediately for approximately the same material. And I wonder if the blogosphere has changed the calculus of the reporter's responsibilities in any way.
GQ paid for me to have access to that interview. which is why I was particularly very careful to make sure not to use anything in that posting that was not directly in the interview. But certainly it's an issue. You know, it's something that everyone has to be kind of aware of because it is a little bit of a different situation now. And I think to me, it wasn't a matter of repurposing information as much as it was taking something that was in the public sphere and the story had been out for a month and using it to go into a different point altogether.
All right, Will. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thanks for having me, sir.
Will Leach is the editor of the sports blog Deadspin and author of the new book. And bear with me, this is going to take a minute. God Save the Fan, How Preening Sportscasters, Athletes Who Speak in the Third Person, and the Occasional Convicted Quarterback Have Taken the Fun Out of Sports, and How We Can Get It Back.
Up next, torture-inspired couture on the runways of Paris.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a couple of your letters. This from Jeremy Bernstein, who wrote in about last week's interview on Bobby Fischer, in which we aired a snippet of his interview with Mike Wallace just prior to his famous match with Boris Spassky in 1972. That year, Bernstein covered the famous match for Playboy. He says he was also playing a lot of chess with Stanley Kubrick at the time. He and Kubrick apparently listened to Fischer's interview with Mike Wallace together and were fascinated. Jeremy Bernstein writes, Kubrick and I could not believe what we heard, and he got the transcript, which I have lost. In fact, no one who has written about Fischer has been able to turn up this interview until you did. Where did you find it? The answer, Jeremy, is Andy Lancet, who curates the WNYC archive.
And we have a letter from Thomas Koppel, who knows well the so-called and offensively named Filipino monkey, the character whose audio was heard coming across maritime channels during the recent U.S.-Iran boat incident in the Strait of Hormuz. Thomas wrote, I have worked in the Persian Gulf several times in the last 3 years. From time to time, my job required that I stand watch on the bridge, and that is where I first heard the monkey. The fact that almost all monkey transmissions are on UHF Channel 16, the emergency channel, that means they cannot be turned off or the volume turned down. The transmissions tend to occur between 10 p.m. and 4 a.m., so anyone on the bridge at the right time is subject to a truly bizarre experience. Hours of nonsense, noises, horrible insults, heckling of other ships' radio transmissions, or insane requests. This chatter can at times be irritating or worse, but from time to time it is very funny. So to me, the mere mention of the monkey on OTM was so unexpected that I completely lost it. I know this reaction is strange, but you have to be a bit strange to work on ships.
And on radio shows. Thanks for the letters. Keep them coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
The idea of influencers, trend-setting social connectors who have relationships with a vast array of people, was one of the stickiest ideas in a book full of them, Malcolm Gladwell's bestseller, The Tipping Point. The argument went that there are a tiny number of influential people who make the difference between small fads and full-blown sensations. The world of brands saw in these influencers the perfect opportunity for targeted, highly efficient marketing and have spent big bucks currying their favor. But not so fast, says Clive Thompson. He writes in February's Fast Company magazine that Gladwell's idea of influencers is built on shaky ground, an old and imperfect study.
He starts off with a Stanley Milgram 6 degrees of separation experiment. You might remember that one. Milgram took a bunch of letters and gave them to people across the country and said, I want you to get them to this stockbroker in Boston. You know, without knowing who this person is, you pass it to a friend who you think is closer. They'll pass it to someone who's closer. And basically, he proved that about 6 degrees of separation is what connected people from this complete stranger. But the really interesting thing was that when it came to the last chain getting to the stockbroker, most of the letters went through just three friends. So essentially what Gladwell found interesting is the idea that there were these gatekeepers. He decided that they were connectors, as he called them.
Yeah, so I happen to be writing a book on approximately this subject, and as part of my research I've accumulated, I'm looking at now a vast bookshelf full of other volumes that deal with the idea of influencers. And the one thing that all of these books have in common while talking about the key to finding the influencers, none of them actually gives you the key. Is there a way to locate these hyper-connected individuals who unlock vast marketplaces?
One of the problems that a lot of the ways people identify trendsetters or tipping point people or connectors is that they do it, you know, in reverse. They take a successful story, like Malcolm Gladwell did with the success of Hush Puppies, that went from being this completely neglected brand to being like a national craze within 2 years with no advertising, all word of mouth. So he sort of traced it backwards to find the first people who were wearing them. And he says, well, these were the incredibly important people that started the trend, the cool kids. The problem is, it's not a very scientific way of doing it. Vision's always 20/20 in hindsight. You know, anyone can figure something out in reverse. The trick is, can you predict? It turns out that almost no one can do that. And people are saying, well, if this can't be systematized in any way, if you can't use it for predictive power, what good is it? Isn't it just a bunch of just-so stories?
You know, you're not just pulling this out of your hat. You've spoken to the people who understand this really on a granular level. I'm thinking of Duncan Watts, whom you spent a lot of time with. Tell me about Duncan Watts and what he has to say on this subject.
Well, Duncan Watts is a network scientist at Columbia University. He's actually on leave. He's at Yahoo right now. When Watts actually tried to replicate the Stanley Milgram experiment, he gave thousands of people email and said, well, get it to the stranger. You know, send it to a friend, to a friend, or a friend till it gets to the stranger. And sure enough, 6 degrees was the number of links to get to the stranger. But there were no all-important connector hubs. Only 5% of the messages went through highly connected people. The rest of them just went sort of democratically through people that were weakly connected together. The data seemed to show that those connectors really are not out there in the way that they're supposed to be. What Watts seems to have found, what he argues, is that it's not how influential each person is. It's how influenceable everyone else is. So to put it another way, if society is sort of ready to embrace a trend, almost anyone can start it.
Well, does he offer any insights into how fads or crazes do catch on? Is there any secret that he's been able to ascertain as to why one video goes all over the world in days and another one languishes unviewed on YouTube?
No. And this is actually the particularly distressing answer for people that are in marketing, because they want to know what the secret is. And his answer is that it's actually pretty random. He'll run these simulation models over and over again, and trends will emerge in his virtual societies. But where it will emerge is almost completely random. So his argument is that what you need to do if you want to start a trend is just try and do good old-fashioned mass marketing. Hit as many people as you can, because you don't know who of them is going to be the match that starts the blaze. The other interesting thing about this is that when people talk about influentials, all this theory is all about people in the real world away from their computers just talking to each other. It's very open. If I talk to you about my great new iPod, you know, what do you take away from that? Do you take away my enthusiasm for it? Do you think about the product? Do you just think about music you like? It's very hard to figure out exactly what I'm transmitting to you. Now, online, you've got links. And those are very concrete, specific things. They're not fuzzy at all. And it immediately teleports the viewer to that place. And you can count them via Google and find them. So I think that the way that influence works online with blogs and links may be closer to this old theory of influentials. It may be more real online than it is in the real world.
Now, Watts at the moment is consulting for Yahoo. And I'm curious in what ways he's applying his research to this internet company.
Well, one of the things that Watts has come up with is the idea that, okay, if trends cannot reliably be started by influential people, and if it's true that almost any average slob can start a big trend. Well, then what's the best way to start one? He has this thing called big seed marketing, where essentially what you do is you take classic mass marketing, you just blast your message out to the public at large, but you also, in an online forum, allow them some interesting tools to spread and share the message around. He used this piece of software called ForwardTrack. You'll see the ad you've put online, and it'll say, you know, click here to send it to a friend. Okay, well, most people ignore that. But what ForwardTrack does is that it allows you to send it to your friends, and then you can see who they send it to. And people got sort of addicted to it. And they became very interested in seeing how big they could make their network. He literally turned, you know, ad forwarding and message spreading into sort of a Facebook-like entertainment. And sure enough, he did this with several different campaigns, and essentially for free, they as much as doubled the number of people that saw the ads.
Wow. Well, Clive, as always, thank you so much.
No problem. Take care.
Clive Thompson is a contributing writer for Wired, the New York Times Magazine, and Fast Company. His article, Is the Tipping Point Toast?, is in the February issue of Fast Company magazine.
In the 2001 film Zoolander, Ben Stiller plays clueless male model Derek Zoolander, who's manipulated by the evil designer Mugatu, played by Will Ferrell. Here, Mugatu explains the inspiration behind his latest collection.
Let me show you the future of fashion. Let me show you derelict! It is a fashion, a way of life inspired by the very homeless, the vagrants, the crack whores that make this wonderful city so unique. And I want you, Derek.
The film is hilarious and ridiculous, but not entirely fictional. British designer John Galliano used clothing worn by the destitute as an inspiration for a line in 2000, a hobo chic look. This year, Galliano's making a different statement. His designs seem to be inspired by torture. Galliano's fall 2008 men's collection features young men painted to look bloody and bruised, wearing hoods and ropes around their necks and not much else besides underwear. More specifically, they look like they came from Abu Ghraib. Designers like Galliano have made political commentary of their clothing for years. Kathleen McDermott teaches fashion history at the Rhode Island School of Design. She says these designs are meant to shock.
I think they look frightening and disturbing and distressing. And I think that's exactly what he's trying to do.
It doesn't seem exploitative to you? An attempt, if not to commodify horror, then at least to fetishize it?
I see it as a profound effort to use a bully pulpit to deal with issues that ordinarily you wouldn't think of as fashion issues.
What kind of a designer is John Galliano?
One thing I've personally always noted about him is that he's somebody who is very interested in many different eras, but always with a twist. For example, he might do something taking on the clothing of the Ancien Regime, the period just before the French Revolution, okay? Mm-hmm. But he would show you little bloody slashes across the neck where the guillotine would be, with blood dripping down. So he's always a guy who makes beautiful, beautiful, beautiful things, but there's a very strong edge. I feel like he uses his enormous intelligence and knowledge of the history of fashion to provoke the viewer and have them ask questions.
Tell me about some other designers currently who are using their collections to make shocking political statements.
One that comes to mind most vividly is a designer by the name of Hussein Chalayan, who created a collection around the chador. It started out at the traditional length, so the woman was completely covered. All you could see were the little holes for the eyes. But the actual garment kept getting shorter and shorter and shorter until her whole genital area was exposed. And so there's another example where somebody is using the opportunity that they have to engage the public in a dialogue. Is that garment a political garment? Is it used to exploit women or protect them?
What was the reaction to his collection?
It ran the gamut from outrage, hostility, laughter, you know, approval. It was exactly the reaction that somebody would want to have.
When did designers start using their designs as political commentary?
Probably the most important period is the 19-teens and 20s, and the place I would start would be the revolutionary artists of the Bolshevik period in Russia, who were very interested in casting off what they thought were idle aesthetic types of forms and designs. And they used abstraction and geometry to create what they called political clothing, and clothing that could be used and efficiently created in the first worker factories. And so these were artists as political revolutionaries trying to create clothing that had a message both built into it and visually apparent.
It seems as if these designs reflected what was going on in visual art at the time and architecture.
Very much so.
How do Coco Chanel's early designs fit into all of this?
Well, hers were profoundly political in a very different way, in that as a young woman at the turn of the century, her background, illegitimate, in poverty, there was such a stigma attached to the kind of origins that she had. She developed clothing that was deliberately classless. That is, the little black dress, except for the extreme fine points of fabric and cut, you could not tell a duchess from a cleaning lady. That was very, very important to her, as was her costume jewelry, because for her, being able to pass at any level was profoundly important and profoundly political.
Why did all this start in the 20s? It was all a reaction to the First World War?
Well, if you think about it, the 20s was a time of tremendous ferment by youth. The people who were reacting against the carnage of World War I were the young people. Also, it was a time of great ferment for women, much like the period that we'll come to later in the 1960s. Those are sort of sister decades in the 20th century.
So let's talk about this sister decade. Then fashion was ruled by the youth culture, as in the 20s, and it was rejecting the war. Did we ever see the war depicted on the runway?
You never saw it in the runway, and that's a very interesting question, and I'll explain why. But what you now take for granted, that is, that people can express their political views in their clothing, was born out of the protest culture of the 60s. It happened in the street. People took back fashion, if you will, away from designers. And let me say that people wear $120 pairs of jeans and think, oh, well, jeans are jeans. Well, in the 1960s, jeans were one of the most revolutionary and profoundly political things you could wear. When Woody Guthrie wore jeans, when Bob Dylan wore jeans in the early part of the 1960s, they were saying, we are in political solidarity with the poorest and hardest working people in America, coal miners and farmers. So while designers weren't protesting the war, people were.
On the other hand, the miniskirt was invented on the runway. This was something that was commodified and churned out.
Mary Quant invented the miniskirt, and she couldn't be more clear about the reasons why. She did not want to look like the old fogies of her mother's generation. These were not commodified pieces. They were pieces coming out of a revolutionary, rebellious spirit.
Now let's go back to the beginning and talk about that line launched by John Galliano for Christian Dior back in 2000. That's the one inspired by homeless people that was parodied in Zoolander, hobo chic, so to speak. Do you remember that line?
Mm-hmm.
What did you think of it?
Well, to me, it's the same. He is engaging the public. What's the connection between rich and poor? What's the connection between the person on the street and the person who buys couture clothes? To me, he's using his pulpit in a responsible way.
Kathleen, thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome.
Kathleen McDermott teaches fashion history at the Rhode Island School of Design.
I am vile, spew, wretched mass. I am really, really dirty. I am derelict.
That
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Paul Schneider. We also had help from Nadia Zonis and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.